you won't bet that all you gotta do is open up your eyes and you wake up screaming and you realize that it's all come true.
Hush now, don't you believe it.
Exciting information to the internet airwaves on a regular basis, the airing most important issues that don't get covered enough. Well, we're living in post-Orwellian world. Hard to explain, you know, just how bad the Matrix has gotten, but probably the whole thing really started going downhill in a big way on November 22nd, 1963. And, you know, that probably along with 9/11 marks the two key moments in the destruction of anything remotely resembling American democracy. What really happened on that day in 1963 when it all went wrong? The day the music died. Let's talk a little bit about the details. The devil is always in the details. We know that insiders killed JFK, but who precisely were they? The case is getting solved bit by bit, and the details are falling into place. The puzzle pieces are being put together, and my guest today, Ole Damgaard, is in the forefront of people putting those details together. He's been working with Jim Fetzer and others on diagramming and outlining precisely who was involved in killing President Kennedy, and he's come up with a long list of names, precise details backed up by witnesses and other forms of evidence. It's fascinating stuff. So tell us about it. Ole Damgaard, welcome.
Thank you so much, Kevin. I just want to say first of all, the reason why the JFK assassination is so important is not just because a president was shot, but according to my 30 years of research, and many other people would agree with me on this one, is that the people, the power elite that took him out, has been the same power elite that are behind so many, if not all of these major political hits, assassinations and terror acts that has been happening ever since, including 9/11. And this is one of the things that I've been very focused on, is trying to, on a street level, find out who were involved in these different assassinations, like JFK, Robert Kennedy, Martin Luther King, Oklahoma City, 9/11, the Swedish Prime Minister Olof Palme, Uwe Barschel in West Germany, Robert Smith in South Africa, you got Che Guevara, you got Salvador Allende in Chile, and so on. And what I managed to find is that we're talking about the same power elite that has been using the same team of assassins for all of these years, that started in the late 1950s, and it's worked its way all up until today, more or less. Some of them are still active to this very day. So this is why I find it's extremely important to try and reveal in great detail what actually took place that day in Dallas, because that was the... sometimes it's been called the grandmother of all assassinations. It's even been used by the CIA and the education programs for the new staff and so on, and military as well, how to get away with a perfect political assassination on the highest level, president level. So this is why it's a key and the best example ever. I think they've never pulled off a thing like that ever since.
I agree. Although 9/11, I think, was similar in many ways. In both cases, these were very, very complex, sort of over the top operations with, you know, huge numbers of people. It must have been extremely compartmentalized. And, you know, one of the issues that gets raised when you look at things like 9/11 and JFK, with all of these different teams working together from different groups. With JFK, we have CIA, we have Mafia, you know, we have Dallas Police, we have LBJ and his hitmen, we have, you know, this particular organized crime group and that organized crime group. And, you know, the question arises, well, how do all of these totally disparate groups work together? And something like that seems to be the case with 9/11 as well, where we have the Israelis, we have U.S. military and intelligence people, we have some, maybe some private contractors. You know, it's, it seems like, in both of the CIA, you know, the CIA was key in both operations, or, you know, some corrupt CIA people, but it's, kind of mind-boggling how these seemingly very different groups can work together on such big operations and not get caught.
But the thing is that they did not work together. It's like you say, it's totally compartmentalized. People only know their very, very small little part in it. Some of the people involved in the assassination had no idea that it was an assassination. They were there for to deliver fake Secret Service IDs, or they were there to deliver, you know, do the logistics with some cars or whatever. They had no idea, and suddenly they found themselves involved in this massive thing. But this is standard. When you see the templates they follow, it is crucial that no one knows more than their little part. Otherwise, if somebody is taken down or decides to become a whistleblower, it will put a risk to the whole operation. So it's just like when, if they drop people behind lines, enemy lines in a war situation or something like that, the people that are dropped there, they will not know anything else but their little part, because if they're taken, tortured, whatever, they can give up the whole network. And so they do it, they follow exactly the same template. So, like I say, the people involved, many of them didn't even know what was going on.
And, of course, Chauncey Holt is the guy who's gone public about having been sent to Dallas to hand out fake Secret Service IDs. And he said when he got there, Dallas was like a Soldier of Fortune convention. All of the best-known, most accomplished bad guys, assassins, and high-level criminals in the world seemed to be assembling in Dallas for what the CIA had codenamed the Big Event.
Exactly, Chauncey Holt says, and this is, he's not the only one, there's quite a few who has been talking about this, but they've only described their little part of it, and also, so what I've been doing is put together this massive jigsaw, trying to put in all the different pieces, one part of where people involved have told about their little part, but also what witnesses have seen, and get it all to fit together. So one of the things, one of the ways that I've done this is by tracking down the vehicles, how they got into Dallas that day, who came with them and so on, who was driving, what vehicles that was observed by witnesses and so on, and also how they got away afterwards from Dallas. Because it's just like you say, this is a cooperation where the key people or the key members in this unholy coalition is the CIA, the mob, the Secret Service, part of the Dallas Police, part of the FBI, and so on. We're not talking about the whole organizations, we're talking about rogue elements within, but also LBJ, Richard Nixon, Operation 40, this hit special hit team of especially exiled Cubans that was put together to take out Fidel Castro and so on. All of them are part of this, and all of them just like when they killed Julius Caesar, all of the different parts had to supply shooters to this so that nobody could start pointing at someone else. Everybody had to dip their hands in blood so that, so that everybody was guilty.
Well, you know, a lot of people have a hard time imagining how all of these groups could be coordinated in this way. The Onion actually did a parody. It was like a, you know, conspiracy theory JFK parody in which the headline was something like CIA, Mafia, Dallas Police, FBI, DEA, blah, 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 killed Kennedy or something like that, thinking it's humorous to imagine that so many different groups could have done it. But you're saying that people from all of these different agencies did. And that raises a question. Maybe, you don't have to get to it yet, but the obvious question is, what's the mechanism? Is there maybe, some kind of, Freemason, secret society that gets people to, swear allegiance to some rogue network that infiltrates all of these different agencies? Or, what is the mechanism for somebody in the command center issuing the orders that result in all of these different cells managing to work together in a compartmentalized fashion?
It is a highly, highly, highly complex conspiracy, this, and it's made on purpose in multi-layers that are pointing in different directions as well. There were several teams active this day that did not know about each other. One part was trying to abort the whole, to stop the whole operation, and it was put together like that to make total confusion for someone like myself or you or whoever. That's why it's been 50 years and people are still discussing this thing, because it is so complex. And that is why I hope and believe that I've been able to now start to sort out a lot of these question marks just by putting together the different pieces.
Okay. So, then let's look at some of the details first. And at some point, though, I'm curious about, who you think might have been giving the orders, because obviously in this kind of operation there has to be a sort of a hierarchy of command, so at least one person has to have a general overview.
The general overview, I mean, this is the higher up you get in the power pyramid, the more foggy it gets, who actually made the layout of the whole operation. There's different military people on the high, General Edward Lansdale. There was Charles Cavell that was fired by JFK. The former CIA boss, Alan Dulles, was deeply involved with this. Lyndon Baines Johnson, deeply involved. J. Edgar Hoover, deeply involved. Richard Nixon, deeply involved. George Bush Sr., deeply involved. And this is not just empty words. I base this on evidence. And one of there was a key meeting the night before the assassination at the Clint Murchison Ranch just outside Dallas. Clint Murchison was one of these oil tycoons that was so against Kennedy. One of the reasons why they hated him was that he was trying to change one of the tax,
depletion allowance. He wanted to end the depletion allowance, which would have cost big oil billions of dollars.
That's the one. So some of the people in Dallas, like Clint Murchison, H.L. Hunt, and other of these multi-millionaire in Dallas, they really wanted him stopped. It's like I say, it's so complex. So if you want, I can go into the different details.
Let's start by kind of saying, okay, we've got, we're imagining that one of these high level guys, and I would guess Lansdale would be a possibility, or somebody working with Lansdale who is giving the orders and sort of sketching it out and saying, okay, we're going to have this team doing this, we're going to have that team doing that. So what are the key teams here that, perform the key actions to accomplish the JFK assassination?
Okay, there was at least three teams. I tell you, there was so many different shooters around Dealey Plaza this day. I think people make a major mistake when they say that, the driver shot JFK, or, there's this thing about Jackie, maybe she shot him and so on.
Yeah, no, those look like disinfo to me.
You have to look at the big thing. What kind of power could cover this up, could pull it off, could stop the control media could, I mean, we're talking, when you start looking at it on that seat, from that way, you will see that it takes enormous power in a very, very high position to be able to control these events. And this is why key people like J. Edgar Hoover, who was at that meeting the night before at the Clint Murchison Ranch, L.B. Johnson, Lyndon Baines Johnson, the vice president who took over after him, he was also at that meeting. Richard Nixon, who was the one who put together Operation 40, this top team of super assassins, and the man that was stood for the funding of this Operation 40 was George Bush Sr. At that time, he was a young man, but that was him. These people were all around or in Dallas that day, including Sam Giancana from the Chicago mob. He was at the Adolphus Hotel in just a few blocks away from Dealey Plaza. And I believe that that Adolphus Hotel was where the commander's center was, because when you look at these big conspiracies, there's always like a technical center where the communications is, coordinated from. And it seems like that was the place.
Very interesting. And that hasn't been discussed a whole lot. You know, I don't recall hearing about that command center from some of the books I've read. Is this new information?
This is so. I believe that a lot of what I'm going to talk about now is not maybe new information, but when I put it together, suddenly it shows a different picture than has been presented before.
Okay, so well, continue that.
So, now, I if you want to, I can go into the different vehicles, how the different teams came into Dallas, because you can see, I mean, on one level, there's all of these massive signs of a conspiracy in the way that if you see how the whole thing was arranged in Dallas, like the route where the motorcade came was changed on a very late date, the morning or the day before the assassination. It was changed from just going mainstream street straight down through Dallas and to the trademark where he was supposed to hold a speech. There's quite a few things that shows that there were three different positions in Dallas this day where there was a possible hit to be done. One was at the airport, one was at Dealey Plaza, and one was at the trademark. They had tried to hit him in Miami before and Chicago, but they called off this operation because of different circumstances. So Dallas was also the perfect place to get him. They tricked him more or less to get down there through John Connolly, who was governor at that time. He was in the motorcade. He was in the same limo as JFK and Jackie. But John Connolly was a 20-year-old friend of Lyndon Baines Johnson. He was the governor of Texas. He was in control of a lot of things there. And he was also very much hand in hand with Johnson. There was a big scandal, I think it was in 1947 or something like that, where where he was elected, Johnson, on a lower level. And there was a lot of frauds with the votes and so on. And it was John Connolly that was his campaign manager when this happened. So they go way back. And they tricked him to come to Dallas because there was also where the mayor of Dallas at that point was, his name was Earl Cabell, and he was the brother of Charles Cabell. That was one of the tops within the CIA that JFK fired. So through the control of J. Edgar Hoover, who was involved, Lyndon Johnson, who was involved, the mayor of Dallas, the governor of Dallas, and the control through J. Edgar Hoover with the FBI so that they can control the investigation right away, and that also with different contacts through the Secret Service, which made it possible to pull back all the security. Like when you see the whole setup of the motorcade was totally breaking all types of rules. normally they would, the Secret Service and other security forces would fly in like weeks ahead or maybe even a month, check all the positions along the route, check buildings, check everything so that there would be total control, you know, no open windows, no possibility to get to the president. And also the limo would be in the middle of the whole motorcade, surrounded by motorcycles in front, on the side and behind. You would have Secret Service people running on the side of the limo or standing on the behind. They had like special handles where the agents could stand and so on. And also there would be loads of, I mean, you would very much notice that the military was there, security was there, everything. All of this was pulled back, pulled back, pulled back. And instead they put the limo right up in front. That was vehicle number two. There was only one vehicle in front, and that was driven by the police chief of Dallas, Jesse Curry, and Bill Decker, who was also high up in the one of the sheriffs there. That was the only vehicle in front, and like the motorcycles were pulled back so that there was absolutely open, the field for fire was open from all sides around it, and the Secret Service men were ordered at the airport by Emery Roberts, one of the Secret Service officers in charge that day. He ordered some of the Secret Service to leave the presidential limousine alone, that they were not allowed. And also the physician, JFK's physician, that was supposed to be close to him at all times, he was placed in the last car in the whole motorcade. Also you had the press car that was normally in front so that they would be able to film the whole thing. That was pulled way back as well. So the whole thing was just wrong. Wrong, wrong.
Well, they pulled away his protection, of course. And Jim Fetzer believes that the Zapruder film has been altered, and what actually happened, which you don't see in the Zapruder film, is that the limousine came to a complete stop, allowing an easy front headshot that killed Kennedy.
Yeah, I totally agree with that. When you come, I'll come to the Zapruder film down the road. But that has been altered for different reasons, I would say. And some of that I would say where I have a little different angle to it or an additional angle than Jim. So, but if we can get, once we get to Dealey Plaza, I'll get into that. Anyway, so also you have, there's a man getting a seizure just before the motorcade arrives. And that makes, he's got one of these epileptic seizures just outside the Daltex building, where the school book depository is as well. So that took care of the ambulance that was parked there, just in case something happened. I mean, if you see all of these signs, they're pulling away all kinds of the ways that the president can survive. And this is standard procedure when you look at these major operations. They do it on a regular basis. Pull them away. So anyway, so when...
Yeah,
when
just like they put to, you know, they made sure the fighter jets wouldn't be in position to interfere with the allegedly hijacked airliners on 9/11.
You can... It's like I say, we're talking a template. They're using the same template. So whatever I say here will fit in 9/11. You will see it in Oklahoma. You will see it in other of these big operations, and many of them abroad as well. When you see different hits in Russia or wherever they hit them, they follow the same template. Anyway, also what they did was, I don't know if your listeners know about the layout of Dealey Plaza. It's a very strange place. There's like you got Main Street going straight down like that, and then it opens up into where Dealey Plaza is, where it's crossed on a 90-degree angle by a street called Houston Street, and then it goes into like a very sharp left turn onto Elm Street, and that is exactly where the school book depository is, where Lee Harvey Oswald is claimed to have shot the three shots from the sixth floor and hit Kennedy killing him there. But then when once you go around that corner, that is where you got some very strange, I don't know what to call them really, but like white walls. I don't know what to call them, but like white walls and almost like white monuments. And then that follows by some trees, a stair coming up, and a picket fence that are covered with trees. And then that street, Elm Street, goes down to what is called the triple underpass, where Main Street, Commerce Street, and Elm Street goes in under. And that it was the way going straight to Trademark, where he was supposed to hold the speech. Anyway, it is totally against all security rules to slow down a motorcade like in any way, because it opens up for the possibility of gunfire from different. It's so much easier to hit something. So these the change of the motorcade was done early that morning, and what they did was they came on Main Street and then turned this 90 degree down on Houston, and then right after that, this very strange left turn at Elm Street, slowing the whole motorcade down. It just stopped more or less, and that made it a perfect position for this hit to be done. If you look at it, it's beautifully executed. And what they did was. I'm not sure if I should go into the different vehicles first, how everybody got in there, or if I should go for the hit itself. What do you think?
While we're on the Dealey Plaza layout, it seems kind of strange that Oswald wouldn't have shot, assuming that Oswald had done it, according to the official story, the window that he was in looks like it would have had a perfect view of the motorcade approaching before it it made the sharp left turn onto Elm Street. So yeah. and it had to stop there. So it would have been stopped basically, or very slowed way down, very close to that window where Oswald supposedly was as it went around that corner. And if somebody were really going to shoot at the president, they would have shot then. Instead, according to the official story, he waited until it was well down Elm Street, and he had a terrible, extremely difficult, if not impossible, shot. But of course the people, who were planted over in that area had the good shot. But, the official story of Oswald doing the shooting the way he did it in that respect is totally implausible.
It's totally impossible. And Oswald being the guilty one, I mean, it's not even up for discussion as far as I'm. Anyone with any kind of brain between their ears, when they look into this in detail, the evidence is so overwhelming, I mean, beyond belief, on a conspiracy, not a lone shooter. It makes absolutely no sense. And this is also why I've spent so many years trying to identify the different players who was involved to get away with any type of question marks around this whole thing.
Right. The issue of Oswald supposedly waiting until he had a difficult, if not impossible, shot when he could have just taken an easy shot a few seconds earlier, it reminds me a little bit of the business of the, supposed suicide hijackers taking an extremely difficult path and doing an amazing stunt flight, probably an impossible stunt flight, in order to hit the unoccupied, recently reinforced wing of the Pentagon furthest away from all the top brass. It's kind of the same situation. If you're really doing this kind of attack, if it were not a false flag, then the people behind it, they would never have done it that way. If there were real hijackings after the Pentagon, you would dive straight into the roof from above and kill thousands.
It's exactly like you say. Many of these cases are no-brainers when it comes to seeing that the official story is not correct. I mean, this is the thing, the wonderful thing with the truth. The truth is, you cannot alter that. You don't have to, everybody who's involved with something where the truth is the power of the whole thing, you have no problem. But as soon as you start turning it into a conspiracy or there are lies involved, suddenly things become really, really complex and extremely difficult for the people involved to keep track of who said who, you know, one lie leads to another lie that goes, it just gets into a massive just mess. And this is, it's like a mess of spaghetti. Then you had to try and untangle the whole thing to see how did this whole thing start.
And that's the interesting thing about 9/11 and JFK is that, you know, in a normal perfect crime, you know, the criminal would try to make sure that, you know, he didn't leave a single clue and that, you know, whatever the alibi was, it would be simple, straightforward, and unquestionable. He wouldn't want to leave any little strand out there that could be pulled to unravel his story. Whereas with these crimes, these perfect crimes of JFK and 9/11, there are, you know, hundreds, if not thousands, of just obvious lies and threads, you know, showing you that the official story can't be true, showing it was an inside job. But there are so many of them that it boggles the mind of the uninitiated. And so people who don't want to believe that such things are possible can just shut off all this information and not have to look at it because there's too much of it.
Hmm. Exactly. It's exactly, and it's made so complex also to just, it's like when what Hitler said, or Göringer, I don't know, what Goebbels, I think, what he said, the bigger the lie, the easier it is to make people believe it.
And in this case, the more complex and sloppy the lie, the less people want to really look into it.
Yeah. Anyway, with the shooter's nest, do you know, like, when I say what they did was that they, one thing that is really interesting with Dealey Plaza this day is since the official route was going straight down Main Street, all the people that were standing next to Houston Street and Elm Street are very interesting because why are they standing there when the motorcade should actually go on the other street? So this is why it's very, very interesting to study all the different photos and films and so on in great, great details, because there is where you will find these people, because we're talking about a lot of people, not all of them involved. But it's almost like one of the people involved, they say it was like the old boys' home. You know, it was just like a rock concert when Michael Jackson came to town. All the local rock stars came to see it. It was, everybody knew that there was going to be a concert, that something big was going down. And they were there. If they were there to confuse, or if they had a purpose, I don't know. But there was a lot of these major assassins there that day. So when you look at the what the witnesses have seen, like for instance, if we take the sixth floor in the Texas School Book Depository where Oswald is said to have been the lone assassin, what did the witnesses see? The few witnesses that saw somebody up there, because 80% of all the witnesses saw the shots coming from the grassy knoll, not from the school book depository. But the witnesses that looked up, they saw people up there. They saw two people with rifles and a third person up there as well. And the way they described them was that the one at the not the window where Oswald is supposed to have been sitting, but on the total opposite side, it's one big room on that floor. So they were in the same room. The person to the left, the furthest left on that building, was a white guy in his 30s with very like horn-rimmed glasses and a hat. White guy. And then on the other, the sniper's nest, there was two men, one of them African, or in those days they said Negro, I mean somebody with very, very dark skin, and a bit of a bald patch, and also a Latin or white guy with a similar bald patch, the white guy with a rifle. Now, according to Cuban Secret Service sources and other sources that I've tracked down over the years, I managed to, in my opinion, the three people up there were Eladio Del Valle. He was part of Operation 40, this super hit team of, it was a super secret team of assassins. When we go through the different people involved, this Operation 40 will come again and again and again and again. That was the one that was a group that was created on the order of President Dwight Eisenhower, who gave his vice president, Richard Nixon, the task of forming this hit team. And the guy, they did it with joint forces from exiled Cubans that was recruited in Miami mostly, and with the lieutenants from the CIA. There were people like Ted Shackley, there were people like E. Howard Hunt, David Attlee Phillips, who was actually the controller of Lee Harvey Oswald, but he was also the controller of James Files, who is the he has admitted to be the shooter on the grassy knoll.
I thought George de Morenschultz was the controller of Oswald.
No, he was one of the contact people. He was not the top controller of him, but he was very much involved. All of these three people, including George Bush Sr., were involved in doing the same around Lee Harvey Oswald. But
Ruth Payne as well, right? Wasn't Ruth Payne involved as well?
Yeah, but she and her husband had connection with the CIA, and they were infiltrating the family. I think that Ruth Payne, I put extreme big question marks around her involvement. But once again, we're talking about total compartmentalizing. They had no idea about the big picture, I would say. Absolutely none. They were just doing what they were told and so on. So, like I said, it was Eladio Del Valle was the shooter. He was a former secret agent on Cuba in the Batista regime. And also, I believe, a police Cuban police that became an exile, and then he was also way up in the government, if I remember right. Anyway, he was the shooter, and the spotter in the window, the man with the dark skin, his name was, he was one of the assassins in Operation 40 as well. His name was Arminio Diaz Garcia, and the man in the left window, the furthest to the left, his name was Richard Kane, a former police officer of Chicago, but one of the lieutenants under Sam Giancana. He was a hitman, high, big time, and he was this day. He and Sam Giancana had checked into the Adolphus Hotel just a few blocks down the road on Commerce Street. Anyway, so we have these three people up there on the sixth block floor. If I stay in this building, if we just take it one building by one and one.
Okay, and we only have maybe 15, 20 minutes left, so we're going to have to kind of zip through it.
Or maybe we can do this in two parts because it's quite complex. It's up to you. I believe that there were some witnesses that after the shooting saw four people run out on behind the school book depository. Three of them got into a car that has been described as the car of Bruce Payne. And the guy that drove it was a man by the name of David Morales, who was way up in the Operation 40. He was also employed by the CIA. He was also at the Ambassador Hotel in L.A. 68 when they took out Robert Kennedy.
He boasted about both hits.
Yeah, and he was also the one that shot Che Guevara in Bolivia under the control of Felix Rodriguez, who was also one of the key people in Operation 40, and later very central. Many of these people are very, very central in the Iran-Contra scandal also later, and the Watergate burglary. Anyway, so the way, there's always been a massive question mark, why was Oswald, he was seen on the second floor in the school book depository just minutes after the shooting, and the manager of the school book depository and a police officer ran in and found him on the second book floor in the lunch room, just standing totally cool, drinking a Coca-Cola. And so
I always thought that would be a good ad for Coca-Cola. Stay cool with Coke. And there's Oswald, like, looking totally cool, not at all excited. This man supposedly just ran down six floors upstairs after shooting the president, and look how cool he is. Drink Coca-Cola, stay cool.
Exactly. But the thing is that why was he there? What was he doing there? And how come, just like you say, how could he get down there? He could not get down there because this day the elevators was not working. And there were some employees, two female employees, that was walking down the stairs at the same time. So there was no way that he could have passed them. But then again, how did the three shooters get out of the building? That is the big question. How did they manage to get down these floors?
That's a good question. What's the answer?
The answer is that these people in Operation 40 and so on, they were highly trained in guerrilla warfare and all types of soldier action. They were part of the Bay of Pigs invasion, so they were trained in all types of
evasion, you know, like, and escape.
Yeah, exactly. And I believe that this elevator this day was not out of order, not working. It was being blocked so that nobody could come up there and disturb them when the shooting was going on. And I think when you see exactly where Lee Harvey Oswald was standing, he was standing exactly where the elevator shacks are at the school book depository. I believe that his part was to see that nobody used it, to block it, and that the shooters got down by using ropes inside the elevator shaft.
Okay, yeah, so they would like rappel down there with ropes, and where, how would they exit the shaft and get out of the building?
On the second, that's exactly where you can get out. You get out on the second floor or the exactly, and out the, it's just like a few meters to the stairs and out on the back side of the building. And when the witnesses saw, there were three people got into this car that has been more or less positively identified as Ruth Payne's car, that was parked on the wrong side of Houston Street, on the corner of where the school book depository is. That is exactly where there's photos of David Morales as well. He's standing up on a lamppost, and you can recognize him there. He's the guy who's Roger Craig later, when the car returns to Dealey Plaza some minutes later, where Sheriff Roger Craig identifies him as the driver, and he says that that is where Oswald got into this car and they took off. Anyway, he takes off, but one of the four starts running down along Houston Street, and this is the same guy, the witnesses who saw him on the sixth floor in the Texas School Book Depository recognize the guy. It's a guy with the glasses and the hat, and he's running down Houston Street looking very sort of scared and like looking to check if he's being followed, and then he turns around the corner and disappears down Commerce Street. And this is exactly just a few hundred meters down the road is where the Adolphus Hotel is, that where Richard Kane, who's been identified as this man, was staying together with Sam Giancana, who was very deeply involved in this whole assassination as well. So I strongly believe that the man running down there was this Richard Kane.
Wow. Interesting stuff. Do we want to move on to a different shooter team in a different place? You know, I know that there's that JFK shooters, what is it, six shooters, none of which was Oswald. That article that Jim Fetzer put out, he names the six shooters and shooter teams. Let me just run down those shooters for you. He says there's Dallas Deputy Sheriff Harry Weatherford was one shooter. Jack Lawrence, a U.S. Air Force expert, is another. Then third is Nestor Tony Izquierdo, an anti-Castro Cuban recruited by the CIA. Number four is Roscoe White, a Dallas police officer with ties to the CIA. Number five is Mac Wallace, Johnson's personal hitman. Number six is Frank Sturgis, CIA man, later Watergate figure. Do you agree that those are the six shooters?
No, I do not. I do not. And I base that on... If we take Malcolm Wallace, he was the henchman of Lyndon B. Johnson. He took out, I think, about six or seven people on the order of Johnson. But this was a guy who killed with different type of toxins and so on. He was not a good shooter, and he was not in any way used to this type of you need to be a very good shooter to hit a moving target like that. The thing with Malcolm Wallace is that his fingerprint was found in on one of the cardboard boxes in the shooter's nest. So for sure, he was there that day. I truly believe that he was part of setting the whole thing up, but I do not think that he was one of the shooters, especially not because of the description, he had these same type of glasses. That is why there's a confusion between these people.
Okay,
Richard Kane on the other side was an excellent shooter, and he's also being pointed out by Sam Giancana's brother and nephew, who wrote a book called Double Cross, where they pointed this guy out. Anyway, Nestor Izquierdo, who he points out, in my opinion, he was the spotter in the Daltex building. He was in that building together with John Rosselli, who was the contact man between the Chicago mob and the government and the CIA. He was later chopped up and dismembered and put in a barrel and thrown in the sea. Johnny Rosselli was there, and the shooter, his name, it was a hitman from the Chicago mob again. His name was Charles Chucky Nicoletti. He was the shooter. Nestor Izquierdo was the spotter. And in the same building, or was the same room when the shots were fired, were George Bush Sr., the man who funded the Operation 40. He was there. It's almost proven 100% now that he was in that building.
Wow, and you know, that's interesting. And just remind the listeners that Johnny Rosselli was supposed to testify to the House Assassinations Committee when he was found dismembered in a barrel floating in the Gulf of Mexico.
So many of these people died very violently later on. They say that if you look at the witnesses and the people involved that have died in a violent way, it's, if you compare to the normal circumstances, it's more than one in a trillion. The chances are more than one in a trillion that this should have happened just by coincidence.
And Ole, you mentioned that Bush, H.W. Bush, was there with this shooter team. And you mentioned that he funded Operation 40, he was a funder for it, or what was his role?
His role was to gather funds, you know, from the military-industrial complex, from the fundraiser, from the oil tycoons to organize the whole fund thing. And one of the men that he was appointed to help him was Felix Rodriguez, this other key person who's been following George Bush Sr. his whole career in these dirty business. He was in Vietnam. He's been all over the place.
Wasn't Rodriguez there with David Morales at the killing of Che Guevara?
Yeah. He was the guy who led the whole patrol, and he was the one that gave David Morales the order to execute him. So, no, he walks around with his watch to this very day if he's still alive.
You know, these guys are, you know, pretty serious killers. And, you know, we only have a few minutes left. So rather than going over more aspects of this very complex assassination of JFK, I was thinking that, you know, there's sort of two more things we could talk about. One is that apparently you're involved with Jim Fetzer in some research with one of the professional assassins who's been involved with these guys, who may be talking now, putting out some information. And so I'd like to talk about that. And then also, finally, if you want to kind of wrap up by bringing us up to date, you know, are there still people like this, or some of these very people running around doing what?
I would say that I would prefer to talk more in detail about this if we make a second.
We can do a second hour on this.
Because these things to come with such heavy accusations, I think it's very important to show that it's well underbuilt, not just empty opinions taken out of the thin air.
Right. Well, but of course, to document this stuff, you know, print is better than just, you know, a radio show. It's hard for us to, like, put footnotes on our spoken words. So as far as the real in-depth documentation, when people want to find out what the sources are for all this, it's better to have that in a print article on the web. But just kind of to wrap up here, did you want to say something about this ongoing research in which an assassin has been talking?
I would prefer to do it in the
second. Save that for the second part. Okay.
Yes,
so then finally, here we are in the post-9/11 world. It was H.W. Bush's son his idiot son, George W., who for some strange reason was parked in the Oval Office for the 9/11 operation, and a Bush crime family and some of these same players seem to have been involved in that in 9/11, as well as the JFK assassination. What are they doing now? And you know, what more can we expect of them in the future?
I'm not sure. I just know that when you look into great details on all of these big major conspiracies the last 50 years or more, the Bush family is, the name Bush is one that recurs all the time, again and again and again, on a scale where the criminality is, it's absolutely mind-blowing, mind-boggling. The things that they have been involved in and controlled and been part of, and it's in my opinion a super super criminal family.
It sure looks that way, doesn't it? And there's even talk that they may be running Jeb Bush, the governor of Florida, for president in the next round of elections. That kind of scares me because Jeb sounds, you know, he looks like he's a guy who's considerably smarter than his brother, George W. Bush.
Yeah, but it's very important to understand that the person in the president's seat is not the guy who's running the show, especially not. It was when George Bush Sr. was in charge. He was one of the key players, so he was actually making some very serious decisions. But like when George came on board, he had nothing to do. He was playing golf, picking his nose, and the whole power machine, this brutal, brutal power machine, killing machine, I would say, that had been in force ever since 1963, were just moving forward like a tank, like this. And the only thing they do is just change this pretty face in front that works well in media and so on. So if Jeb Bush would come, it would just be another different face, but the same brutal killing machine behind it.
Do you think that what percentage of people who work in these government agencies that are penetrated by these criminal groups and end up, you know, being part of operations like the JFK hit 9/11, what percentage of those people do you think actually really understand what's going on? You know, I've had a number of former CIA people on my radio show, Philip Giraldi, who's now outspokenly anti-Zionist, and you know, I had the former head of the Bin Laden unit of the CIA, Michael Scheuer, on the show recently, trying to get Bob Baer, a former top on the ground CIA guy in the Middle East, on the show. And these people, for the most part, don't forget Glenn Carl, the CIA interrogator. These people don't usually really seem to know very much about the kind of organized crime side of the CIA, the Bush crime family side. In some cases, they're in denial about it, like Glenn Carl. In some, I don't think they're so much in denial, but they're not real eager to talk about it real loudly, like Philip Giraldi. And, you know, Michael Scheuer of the formerly of the Bin Laden unit, I don't think he gets that, and I don't think he fully grasps 9/11, although he's not fully in denial either. So you know, how would people in the CIA who think they're doing a relatively honest government job get scammed by these criminals who are working beside them?
I would say, once again, it's compartmentalization. And also, I mean, I think once you get into this sphere of business, you soon find out that you're in deep shark waters, so that you just do your part and shut up and don't see, don't hear, don't talk this, because like the secrets, the CIA have a very violent way of dealing with things with opposition and whistleblowers and so on. So I cannot blame them if they are not very eager to speak.
Well, I guess Bob Baer picked the right title for that first book, his best-selling book that came out after 9/11, called See No Evil. Maybe the CIA should change its motto from "The Truth Will Set You Free" to "See No Evil, Hear No Evil, Speak No Evil," and they should put up a statue of the three monkeys in front of the headquarters at Langley, Virginia. And I guess that would put them on par with the Mossad, whose official motto is, "By way of deception, thou shalt do war." it's pretty amazing. People work for these agencies and consider themselves patriots, and yet they're really doing the work of scoundrels. Well, Ole, it's been great, and we are going to have to do another hour on this because you have a lot more detail about the JFK hit and this, say 40 organization, this, what's it called? Organization 40, I'm sorry, Operation 40 team.
Operation 40.
Operation 40 that's been around for so long and involved in so many, really evil and deceptive crimes. Well, I appreciate your excellent research. Keep up the good work, and I look forward to the next conversation.
Thank you so much. Can I just say my website is lightonconspiracies.com, lightonconspiracies.com, and I've written a book about the Swedish, the killing of the Swedish Prime Minister Olof Palme, and with lots of connections to many, many of these other major assassinations. It's called Coup d'etat in Slow Motion, and it's available there.
Okay, highly recommended. Lightonconspiracies.com, and the book is Coup d'etat in Slow Motion. Well, thank you.
Can I also say, Kevin, that any type of donations or signing up for my newsletter is highly appreciated, because research like this, it's very, very hard without having some kind of income. So anybody who wants to support me is extremely appreciated.
Okay, go to lightonconspiracies.com and help keep real investigative journalism and history going. Well, thanks, Ole Vomgren. It's been a pleasure. I look forward to the next show.
The pleasure is mine, Kevin. Thank you so much for having me.
All right, well, thank you for coming.
Who killed John Colombo? Who killed John Colombo? Who killed John Colombo? Who killed John Colombo? There was a kill, John Colombo. He shot him 4 times in the head while he was driving his taxicab. Dale Wilson was sitting in the back seat of the taxicab. Suddenly, he pulled out his .38 and opened fire. He was arrested and charged with first-degree murder. Who killed John Colombo? 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 Dale Wilson went to court. He was arraigned. He went on trial. The evidence stated that Dale Wilson shot John Colombo in the head 4 times with a .38 while he was driving his taxicab. Who killed John Colombo? Who killed John Colombo? Who killed John Colombo? Who killed John Colombo? Lasted 8 weeks. The verdict was in. A jury found Dale Wilson guilty of first-degree murder. A month later, he was sentenced to 80 years in prison. Who killed John Colombo? Who killed John Colombo? Who killed John Colombo? Who killed John Colombo? Rock over London, rock on Chicago. Folgers, it's good to the last drop.